Ladies and gentlemen, we're about to start our program. Introducing our host is Karna Bodman. Karna?
Oh, good afternoon, everyone. I am absolutely delighted to introduce our speaker today. A name we're very familiar with is deputy editor of the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, as well as, of course, the author of his weekly column, first must read every morning. Now, you know, I asked Dan some time ago if he'd always wanted to be a writer. You know, it's nice to know. And he told me that, well, yes, he did. But what he really wanted to do was write novels. Good idea, right? Mm. But then he said that when he got out of college, he figured out really quickly, he said, in his words, no one was going to hand me $20,000 to write my first novel. I had to get a real job. So he did hook up with a newspaper, and by the way, that first novel is yet to be written, but, you know, he'd sure have a lot of material. You talk about fiction, ferreting out facts from fake news or, you know, whatever. As for the Journal, he has been one of their top writers ever since Ronald Reagan became president and then, of course, covered every president since then. What does he think of our current president? Well, asked him that. He said that back in November of 2015, when Trump came to visit the Journal editorial staff as he was beginning his run for president, as Dan described the scene, he said he entered the room, swept along the long desk there where we were all standing to greet him, and he said, Paul Gigot, Dan Henninger, you're killing me. But you're going to get to know me now, and it's going to be all right. The question is it all right? Maybe he'll tell us. Dan Henninger, please give a welcome.
Thank you very much, Karna. Yes, it is a good question. Has it been all right? And we're going to try to get into some of that here this afternoon. It is... I am really happy to be down here in Naples, Florida. A day or two before I left New York City, walking to work, the main task was to make sure you didn't slip on the ice and break your leg or something worse. And when I arrived at Naples Airport, I looked around and half the people had short pants. I was really taken aback. It was a wonderful sight. I've been writing this column for quite a while. It started the Friday after 9/11, which was a Tuesday, and I was scheduled. I wrote an eyewitness piece about seeing 9/11, and I told the editors if I'm going to write a weekly column, it has to start this Friday. And it's appeared in the Journal virtually every Friday since. As some of you may know, it is it's called Wonderland. And people used to say to me, why do you call your column, that's right, I'll get this out of the way. Why do you call your column, is this on? Yeah. Why do you call a column Wonderland? And nobody asks me that anymore. They sort of feel there's a really kind of Alice through the looking glass quality to our politics these days. And indeed there is, and I'm going to try to get into a bunch of that here. There's a lot to talk about, for sure. But the problem is there is never enough time these days. So I've decided that the only solution here at the Forum Club is to bend time. I'm going to give two speeches this afternoon, all in 30 minutes, mainly because I'm just getting one shot at the Forum Club's wonderful audience. And there are two main things that I wanted to talk about. One, of course, is you-know-who, Mr. T, as I like to call him. The other is the media. My former colleague, Lionel Shriver, who is indeed a novelist, wrote a best-selling novel whose title was We Have to Talk About Kevin. It was about a problem child. Well, I think we have to talk about the media. There is a problem. The media has gone through 2 years of transformation in its battles with Donald Trump, with much of the American public as bystanders to this struggle and wondering what in the name of heaven is going on. Trump calls it all fake news, and we're going to get to that. But there had to be a reason that the Founding Fathers, more than 200 years ago, made the country's First Amendment about freedom of the press. The Founders' basic insight was that this country was going to be all about contested politics, about one side saying they want this and the other side saying we want something else. And the only way this would work is if the public had access to information about what they were fighting over. And the vehicle for that basic information was going to be a free press. Now we call it the media. And whether you read my paper, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, watch Fox, CNN, MSNBC, or spend all day clicking into websites or Twittering, I'm sure some of you are on Twitter all day, you are engulfed in what we call the media. Now, journalists have been accorded special access to sources of information, not because they're smarter than the rest of the population, but because they're able to call up people who know things, politicians, business people, intelligence officials, and then they're supposed to arrange what they learn in a coherent way and make it available to the public. Anyway, that's the theory. I want to offer you a quick history of American journalism to give you some understanding of how we got to where we are today. Journalism here began in the late 18th century, at the country's founding, when newspapers were run by the political parties themselves, and with much of the material actually written by elected politicians or party professionals. There's a very famous story about Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton being in kind of a death struggle, and Jefferson turning to James Madison and telling him, pick up your pen and cut him to ribbons. Well, towards the middle of the 19th century, the technology that gave birth to more objectivity than that in journalism was the telegraph, connecting cities across the country. The telegraph brought to life the Associated Press Wire Service, which dates back to 1846. Now able to transmit news around the country by electrical wires, the AP tried to supply the country's hyper-partisan newspapers with objective reporting. There was just the news for them, straight down the middle. Then in the 20th century, two different kinds of journalism developed. The sensational yellow journalism of William Randolph Hearst and the model developed by Joseph Pulitzer. Pulitzer invented what became for many years the classic summary of what a reporter is supposed to do with a story. Provide who, what, when, where, and how. Editors back then insisted that the story's factual content appear in descending order of importance, so that the least relevant material was at the bottom, and editors then, as we said, could make a story fit in the space available by cutting from the bottom. In other words, if you read the first five paragraphs into one of these stories, you had the meat of it. You knew what was going on. And by and large, this was the straight style of news reporting that prevailed until at least the 1960s. And then gradually, it began to change. People in the newspaper business started to believe that a new technology, television, was taking away their franchise on simple, straight news reporting. That's right, there really was a time when television news was nothing but the facts. So, some newspapers decided that to add value to their product, they'd add value by publishing more analysis of the previous day's news. Reporters would now tell you not just what was in the news, but what the news meant. Now, this was back in the 1970s. Well, of course, the politicians saw what was going on, and they adjusted. In 1984, at the presidential debate between Ronald Reagan and Walter Mondale, the political professionals started to explain to reporters after the debate the meaning of what they had just seen. And at the time, this was called spin. The politicians were spinning the news. And the reporters back then made fun of it. They called it spin, and they called this place where they would go do the spinning, Spin Alley. All right, fast forward 20 years, and another new technology appears, the Internet. Because of the Internet, a lot of people in journalism concluded that the news had become commoditized by sites like Google News. In other words, the facts, what until then was thought to be the purpose of the news business, were now theoretically free to everyone. And for some people in my business, this meant almost literally that the value of facts had been diminished. In other words, you could no longer make money by simply providing the facts. As a result, highly politicized and partisan websites developed, like Breitbart News on the right and Vox on the left. As a result, a lot of the public decided that if you were always going to be spun by the press, you might as well read websites or newspapers or watch TV stations that will spin you all day long in a political direction that made you feel good, or at least put you in like-minded company. Then along came the election of 2016 between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. I've often said that, I did see the first the movie Star Wars appeared. It's a long time ago, and Starship Fighters and all the rest of that. And at the end of it, I said, movies have changed forever. And they had. Well, that is what has happened to the American media with the election of 2016. We have jumped into hyperspace. We are in another galaxy of news that I barely recognize. Newspapers have been around since the beginning of the Republic, but we're now in uncharted territory as far as facts, spin, opinion, and even reality goes. There is in economics something called Gresham's Law. Gresham's Law holds that bad money drives out good money, cheap money drives out valuable money. Well, it is clear to me that something like a Gresham's Law of information has happened. Bad information, by dint of its sheer, nearly immeasurable volume, is driving out good information. It is killing the facts. Now, I have to say, it sometimes looks to me as if the world is filling up with irrational, illogical, and insane thinking. This dissent is being driven and sustained by social media such as Twitter and Facebook. And eventually, like kudzu, the bad weeds will choke out everything around them. And what would that produce? I think it will produce a political jungle whose rules are the law of the jungle. Which brings us to the main event, Donald Trump and the media. The blood feud between Trump and the media is kind of a chicken and egg story. Who started it? Had American media been headed in this direction for years, or did Trump simply push them over the cliff? Let us at least posit that during the primaries and campaign, Donald Trump singled out the press for criticism at his rallies. They became his target, and at some of the rallies in ways that were pretty ugly. Those of you who read my column know that I said in this week's column that what he did again in El Paso, pointing to the reporters in the back, was just bad. Whatever the disagreements between the president and the press, it is an ugly thing to turn people against reporters standing out there trying to cover an event like that. Nonetheless, past some point, Donald Trump and the American media were at war. But even admitting that reality, it is also clear that at some point, something snapped with the media. And not just the media, but with American elites working in institutions like the FBI. I'm sure by now you've all read the last 24 hours news that Deputy Director McCabe was going to tell CBS 60 Minutes this Sunday that he and others at the FBI were talking about invoking the 25th Amendment to get Trump removed. I call this the Trump panic. After Donald Trump got the nomination, and certainly after he defeated Hillary Clinton, the sense spread that someone really, really unacceptable was about to become president of the United States. And that's when the panic began. This was in the latter half of 2016, when the FBI's Peter Strzok and Lisa Page started exchanging their now famous emails. But recall as well the Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz's report on all this, which he named FBI agents number one and FBI agent five, an FBI lawyer number two exchanging emails that went along the lines of, oh my God, is there any way we can stop this? We were looking at the utter collapse of traditional FBI discipline. Then in January 2017, about the time of the Trump inauguration, the Russian collusion story made its first appearance. The early atmosphere of the Russian collusion story was like the atmosphere of Washington during the years of Watergate and President Nixon. Bombshell after bombshell landed in the news. But back then, it was just the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. Those papers would land on your doorstep in Washington every morning. Those of us who were there will never forget it. But the Russian collusion story was really kind of different. It was hitting the internet nonstop. The number of leaks was mind-boggling. But the most amazing of all was virtually every news outlet on the web would instantly confirm the original story, citing their own intelligence sources. I began to wonder how many intelligence sources, confidential intelligence sources, can there be in Washington talking to all these media outlets? And I've concluded that the short answer, it was the same three or four people talking to all those outlets. Well, the Russian collusion story, at least as the term is normally understood, slowed almost to a halt about a year ago. Nothing significantly new was advancing the story beyond those famous Russian operatives, George Papadopoulos and Carter Page. And believe me, John le Carré is not wasting his time writing a thriller about this one. Then last April, an important media event happened. It was the White House Correspondents' Dinner featuring the comedian Michelle Wolf. The highlight was Michelle Wolf's directed personal insults at Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who was seated right up there on the dais. It's pretty awful stuff. Well, some in the press took Wolf to task afterwards, and it looked for a moment as if there really was a line that shouldn't be crossed anymore. But before long, they had all returned to carpet bombing the Trump presidency. For example, in December, mocking Melania's red Christmas trees. In other words, the sympathy for Wolf's ridicule of Sarah Sanders was, well, fake. Nearly all journalists are on Twitter. They share each other's stories. They reinforce each other's opinions. Journalists post things on Twitter they would never put in their own newspaper or say on camera. Now, one result of this is that many serious people have concluded that most media is now just one big, undifferentiated blur of opinion. Facebook last May released new restrictions on posting what they call political ads, including from newspapers. Facebook considers anything that makes a reference to politics or what they call national issues of public importance as a political ad, and it has to be labeled a political ad. In other words, Facebook is saying what people in media think is news should be explicitly labeled as political advertising. Now, there are a couple of ways to interpret this. One is that Facebook is looking at the press and the media and stating the obvious. If you think everything you read in newspapers, is opinion, then yes, by some definition, it is bias. If it quacks like bias, it is bias. But maybe it's something else too. I had a former editor at the editorial page named Bob Bartley. And Bob used to say when faced with a difficult thing to figure out, think lower. I think some of these outlets have adopted a policy of being anti-Trump and anti-conservative as a business model. By now, much of the media is invested, literally, in the original theory of the Russian collusion. The story is being driven by the fact that readership now can be measured by internet metrics and then targeted with marketing campaigns to attract new online subscribers of people who want more of the same. In other words, there's money to be made in media polarization. politicians cause or promote controversy and then use it the same day to send out emails to raise money. Barack Obama did it all the time. I personally am on Donald Trump's mailing list, and I get a mail email asking for money every time he talks about the wall. Every outrage is a fundraising opportunity. As comedian Lily Tomlin once said, I try to be cynical, but it's hard to keep up. I have had conversations with people who say they're increasingly find it difficult to make sense of everything that's going on. It's such a blizzard of events and opinions. Welcome to the club. I feel that way all day long, almost every day. I have to tell you about one of my primary sources of news. Wall Street Journal is in the same building at 48th and 6th Avenue with Fox News. We're in the News Corporation building. And all of the 6 or 8 elevators in our elevator bank have televisions in them showing Fox News. And you get on that elevator and you always look not to see what anyone's saying, but at the so-called chyron, the strip running along the bottom, to find out if anything's happened between the time you got on the elevator and got down to the first floor. I get my news in the Fox elevators. Truly. Well, ultimately in our time, eventually everything comes around to one subject, and you know what that subject is. Mr. T, Donald J. Trump. Since I live on the island of Manhattan, I routinely run into people who demand to know why I am not in full-throated opposition to the Trump presidency. My answer, which I hope is a serious answer, in part, is that this presidency, like any before it, goes to work every day and consists of thousands of administration officers carrying out the ideas and mandates that brought the president into office. Some good, some not so good. My job, as I understand it, amid the hurricane of news, is to identify what this or any presidency does that is good and what is not. So let's try to put the Trump presidency inside that context, specifically the context of the Obama presidency, which ran from 2009 to 2016. That's 8 years, and 8 years is a long time. We had sub 2% economic growth for an entire 8 years. Economists in defense of the Obama policies said that 2% growth was something they began to call the new normal for the United States. Well, some of us thought the new normal felt a lot like the Berlin Wall, something that was never going to end. And I thought back then, a lot of Americans were losing heart. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics has a stark bureaucratic way of describing what was going on. They have a category called, quote, people no longer looking for work. Well, there were a lot of them during those 8 years, people who had simply given up. Then in 2016, Donald Trump got elected. And with 18 months, the United States had a labor shortage. Unemployment among blacks and Hispanics is at a record low. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said in a speech recently, most Americans who want jobs can find them. Jobless claims are at the lowest level since 1969. Real wages are finally rising. And despite the government shutdown, the economy in January added 304,000 new jobs. Some of us have tried to figure out what the heck was going on. None of us would have anticipated a revival like this, and I think what it really revealed was the inherent submerged existing power of the U.S. economy. It was extraordinary, and once it got released, it exploded. And I think that was sort of the meaning of the Dow Jones Index staying so high through the Obama years. It's forward-looking. There was a lot of anticipation that if the economy ever got released, it would take off. Well, let me say something about this success. It wasn't just Donald Trump. The ideas behind this extraordinary economic resurrection go back to Ronald Reagan. Two of the instruments of Reaganomics were tax cuts and deregulation. The Trump economic policy was about reversing Obama-era regulations, followed by tax cuts. The executors of this Reagan-esque Trump economic policy deserve to be named. One was Gary Cohn, who was then in the White House as the head of the National Economic Council. Kevin Hassett was and is President Trump's primary economic advisor. He had come over for the American Enterprise Institute. Kevin had spent his life studying corporate taxation. He gave speeches around Washington back then defending the idea of reducing the corporate tax, and he was right. There was also the people who cut the regulations across the government, such as Scott Pruitt at the Environmental Protection Agency, Mick Mulvaney at OMB. Of course, now he is Trump's chief of staff. They knew where to look. They knew what to reverse. And on taxes, there were a whole list of people. It included, indeed, Paul Ryan, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Kevin Brady, his predecessor, Congressman Dave Camp of Michigan. These people had been working on a plan to do something rational with taxes for years. When the opportunity presented itself in 2017, they took it. And the results, the economy we have now, is really ultimately, if you are serious about being in politics, the whole point of what we do. Now, Donald Trump's personality and operating method, the art of the deal, is in front of us all the time, and indeed, it overwhelms everything. But this economic achievement, which the president put in motion and supported, was the result of standard policymaking and politicking. And that's what I meant by looking past the surface of media events now to see if what is happening behind it is good or bad. Now we're at the start of the third year of the Trump presidency, and the challenges of the Trump operating method are going to be more formidable. His negotiating partner overseas is Xi Jinping, the leader of a nation of 1 billion people. His negotiating partner in the United States is Nancy Pelosi, who is no longer just some Democrat, but the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Robert Mueller's special prosecutor report sits out there like a Netflix series that'll never end. And House committee chairmen are plotting impeachment hearings. Before this, the Trump operating method was to force every issue, announce a decision, and force the principals to focus. And as to the details, well, all that could be worked out sometime later. I think it's really a good question whether this is going to work in the next 2 years. The wall, it's a good question whether anything resembling that wall is going to be built anytime soon. We can talk about that later. Probably going to be a lot of litigation before much of it gets built. There is no trade deal with China. The stock market skyrockets or plummets on the slightest news of whether that trade deal is going well. And the negotiation with North Korea's Kim Jong-un is where it was for three presidents, down at the bottom of the mountain. And here at home, well, here at home, we are in the foothills of, you guessed it, another presidential election. Presidential elections are now the real national sport, with a tailgate party that lasts for an entire 2 years. As I speak, I could be wrong, five or so Democrats are already running for the nomination, including Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii. Who is Tulsi Gabbard? What difference does that make? There is one reason 40 or 50 Democrats are running for the presidency. All right, two reasons. The number one and number two are the same familiar answer, Donald J. Trump. You'll recall that at this point in the last election cycle, the number of people who thought Donald Trump could be president was about zero. So now, everyone from Tulsi Gabbard to Howard Schultz to Elizabeth Warren thinks, if it can happen to that guy, it can happen to me. The second Trumpian reason why they're all running is the Democrats assume that whoever the party nominates is going to be the next president, solely because they believe that most of the country has soured on the Trump personality. And they have their reasons, specifically the results of the midterm elections, which made it pretty clear that indeed a lot of suburban Republicans are down on Mr. Trump. And indeed it's true. When Republicans lose control of House seats, as they did in the suburbs of Houston and Dallas, something's going on. Now, there is a school of thought especially among Mr. Trump's critics, that his political coalition in 2016 was a combination of populism, fear, anxiety, and the politics of resentment. A prominent conservative columnist wrote a while back that what Trump had done to American politics is so odious that reason requires that one now vote for Democrats to replace Trumpism. I think the Trump phenomenon is a lot more complicated than this. It has never been obvious to me exactly what Trump's politics are. Mostly it's been a slogan, "Make America Great Again." And I'm pretty sure this makes it the first political philosophy that can be summarized on the front of a baseball cap, MAGA. Personally, I think the Trump philosophy can be summed up in one other four-letter word, jobs. The Trump economic policies described earlier were about creating jobs. The trade policies and the protectionist tariffs are about jobs. You don't have to agree with all these policies. I certainly do not agree with the tariffs and the trade wars. But the goal remains the same, put Americans to work. It's a simple idea, though admittedly Donald Trump sometimes has a complicated way of going about it. As we have seen last week, we had the negotiations over the border shutdown, the wall, and at 11 o'clock this morning, he declared a national emergency to build the wall. This gets a little bit complicated. Jobs may well be mainly what has on Mr. Trump's mind, but I think something more fundamental was on the minds of many people who cast their vote for him back in 2016. I got an email from a reader on this recently. He said the reason he had voted for Donald Trump was mainly in reaction to living under constant pressure the last 40 years from the cultural left in the United States. His word for them was the Nutburgers. This is what he wrote me. When I see long hoped for resistance to those Nutburgers from Trump, which I did not see from Nixon, Ford, Bush 41, or Bush 43, I am unalterably supportive of Donald Trump, flawed vessel or not. It's not the man, it's the resistance that binds us to him. It's the resistance that binds us to him. This political sentiment is about something bigger than Donald Trump. It is pushback against the cultural triumphalism of the left on matters like identity politics. It is an understanding that the American left doesn't merely disagree with its opponents, but dislikes and perhaps even hates them. The resistance to the left's moral triumphalism did not begin in 2016. It will not end in 2020. And if Democrats are expecting to win solely on the basis of Donald Trump's personality, they may be misreading the mind of the American voters. It's possible that at least half the electorate will, for a second time, default to voting for Donald Trump because of what the Democrats have come to stand for on the direction of the culture. They themselves have one word for it now, socialism. I was really struck by some of the numbers about the president's support among Republican women in a recent Fox News poll. His support among Republican women is 93%, 8 points higher than among Republican men. In fact, when asked if 2018 had been a good year for them and their families, 72% of Republican women said it was. As a matter of fact, 41% of Democratic men said 2018 had been a good year for them, and 35% of Democratic men, a third, say they are hopeful about the country's direction. These Democratic men have to be the most deeply closeted class of people in American life. I never meet them. Now, this doesn't mean Republican women think they're living in some sort of Trumpian la-la land. More than 70% of them are upset at the country's deep political divisions. So let's talk a little bit about those divisions. If we're going to discuss a populist politics of resentment, then I think it's worth noting that Barack Obama originated the modern politics of resentment with his constant speeches. If you may recall, they were constant, about what he called the wealthiest and the 1%. This routine scapegoating of the wealthiest, it was actually a thought-out political strategy. And on the political left, the Bernie Sanders left, the Elizabeth Warren left, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez left, pretty much all of them, the politics of class resentment is an ideology that has no limits, it has no upper boundary, and it has no incentive to reduce the resentment. It is how they animate their voters. The role of the media plays in all this is to keep these assertions up and running, like an offstage chorus repeating the same constant bad news about class division. The answer to that, the antidote to the politics of division and resentment, is in part what we have seen the past year, which is the politics of opportunity. Now, what does the politics of opportunity really mean? Even President Obama gave speeches that talked about the value of individuals trying to do the right thing with their lives and getting ahead. The problem was it did not happen in his two terms, and there was no way it was likely to happen. Now comes Cory Booker, running for president, and this is what he said to explain why he was running. "I believe we can build a country where no one is forgotten, no one is left behind, where parents can put food on the table, and where there are good-paying jobs with good benefits. So here we go again." This is the familiar fight between the left and right about the meaning of the good life and what politics can contribute to achieve it. The Trump campaign and its electoral success did indeed grow out of festering resentments against the economic status quo in places like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and elsewhere. That produced the presidency. The public policy success in the presidency's first year was to restore the American economy. In four famous words, make America great again. As I said, create jobs. It isn't political rhetoric. It is a substantive reality born of politics. The great French interpreter of American life, Alexis de Tocqueville, put it this way: "Turn man's intellectual and moral efforts to the necessities of material life, and use them to improve his well-being." I like that word, well-being. I think well-being is an understandable idea for anyone's politics. Both the left and right lay claim to arguments and ideas they say will provide it. Well, we've just run the experiment, as the American system allows us to do. We had 8 years of one-side solutions, and it did not produce well-being. We're 2 years into the other sides, the side of Reaganesque and now Trumpian economic policy, and we are on the road to well-being. Has each of us arrived at the promised land? Of course not. But let's circle back to where this talk began by describing the evolution of the American press and media from providing facts to now largely providing relentlessly partisan interpretation of the facts, and doing it largely out of commercial self-interest. One result, which America's founding fathers worried about a lot, was that this building up of resentments and political conflicts could overwhelm and erode the nation. My modest argument today has been that for all the tumult of the Trump years, and by the way, has anything happened in the last 30 minutes that I should know about? For all the tumult, the fact remains that this presidency has produced economic prosperity. It has produced a way forward to well-being. Do not forget that the Declaration of Independence, which was in fact a revolutionary document, in that declaration, Thomas Jefferson asserted that our inalienable rights were not just life and liberty, but also the pursuit of happiness. I believe Jefferson understood that if we were able to pursue happiness or well-being, then the unavoidable conflicts of our politics would be containable. The United States would be able to survive and flourish. Anyway, that's my theory, and I'm sticking to it. I know I haven't said a word about Donald Trump's tweeting, but I think you've been listening to me long enough this afternoon, so I'm going to end it right there. Thanks for listening.
That was great. As you can imagine, we have a ton of questions, so maybe keep the answer short or whatever. Anyway, there's so many of these. Okay, first of all, from one of our students over there, it's such a great group of young people here. So glad you're here with us. It says, do you believe that Generation Z has recognized this flood of opinion-based news on their media platforms? Are they choosing to educate themselves on the issues or allowing themselves to be easily impressionable from all these online influences?
Well, that's not only a great question to which I don't have the answer, but I guess the short answer would be I'd love to hear what Generation Z has to say about it. But I have an opinion about what's going on, which is that Millennial, Generation Z, I think I had a reference to it in the talk, this is the generation that was born into the world of social media, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, all the rest of it. And, you know, this is a people have written books about this, a subject for another speech. I just think this phenomenon has changed everything. It has changed our psychology. It has changed the way we think about politics. But fundamentally, I think that if on social media you have all these groups of people together saying the same thing as the journalist, I think that was my reference, saying it over and over and over again, you are involved in a process that resembles propaganda or even brainwashing. It is a neurological event. And there has to be an explanation for why so many people, I think I'm going to write a column about how did the Democratic Party move to the left so quickly? I mean, this is a big story these days. They're all left, Anastasia Cortez and the rest of them. It happened like this. There was no convention. There was no caucus. Nancy Pelosi is like back on her heels about it. I think social media and what the millennials and Generation Z are involved in all day long has a lot to do with it. And whether there'll be a reaction to that and a kind of standing back, I don't know.
You did in your talk tell us a lot about the economy, how we're in better shape, jobs, and so forth. But several questions on this. Do you believe that we will at some point address our federal deficit of $22 trillion?
Yeah, that's quite a number. 23 point something as we speak. It's a good question. President Trump, truth to tell, isn't that interested in this subject. When you bring up with him the question, I mean, what we're talking about here is getting control, not so much of discretionary domestic spending, but entitlements like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And when you put that to Mr. Trump, he does not really want to talk about doing anything to adjust Social Security. At least up to this point, he hasn't, which means that the deficit just keeps spinning. Certainly Republicans in Congress are upset about it. They signed on to it in the last budget, mainly almost solely so they could get military spending increased. This is a big issue among a lot of Republican voters. It's an active issue, and at some point this is going to have an effect on Republican politics. And a good question would be whether there's ever a movement out there that starts leaning on Trump to do something about this the way he thinks his base leans on him about the wall.
You just mentioned the wall. So here's a question. Will the president's emergency powers declaration today be upheld, go all the way to the Supreme Court? And if so, how long will it take to get a resolution of all of this?
It could take at least through 2020, which when, as you may have noticed, we're having a presidential election. There will be lawsuits. There will probably be federal courts that issue injunctions against what he's doing. It could find its way to the Ninth Circuit in California, which obviously would rule against the president, and it's going to wind its way up to the Supreme Court. There could be resolutions submitted in the House and the Senate to overturn the national emergency. It'll pass in the House. Open question whether it might pass in the Senate. There are Republicans who are upset about this precedent that the president is establishing of taking funds for his declared national emergency. They are arguing that why wouldn't a president, Warren, Harris, or Booker, four or so years from now, decide that climate change was a national emergency and start moving funding around to deal with that. So I think this is going to run on till at least the year after next. And make no mistake about it, it allows President Trump to keep it elevated as a campaign issue. And I was kind of wondering whether how he would sort of sign on to a budget resolution that contributed money to the wall, and as some of us said, get it behind him. I don't think Trump really wants the wall behind him. I think he wants it out in front of him so he can talk about it right up through the campaign. And this might do it.
Here's one. I sense that we, the citizens of the United States, will never hear the results of the Mueller investigation. Will we?
I think we have to. I don't think there's going to be much of anything there. Look, as I said, the collusion story has been running the press. The entire press has been chasing this story for months. If 1,000 reporters by now can't find out what Mueller has, there's probably nothing there. I will tell you something intriguing. I think the American people deserve to know what he found out. But John Dowd, who was President Trump's lawyer on all this for a while and is a guy I know, he's in Washington, he just gave an interview to ABC News. And if you want, Google ABC and John Dowd interview Trump. It's absolutely fascinating because Dowd talks a lot about the internal workings of his relationship with Mueller. And he doesn't think that they're likely to issue a report. He said there's nothing in the Justice Department rules that require them to issue a report. And he believes if there's nothing there, they just may set it aside. Now, the implication obviously would be that there was no reason to indict the president. But I think the American people deserve a reckoning on this. I think they deserve to know what the hell was going on with the FBI. The McCabe thing that I just mentioned about the FBI thinking of pressuring for a 25th Amendment, which has nothing whatsoever to do with what the FBI is charged with doing. These are things I think the American people, at least half of them, are pretty upset about, and they deserve some resolution.
Okay, not too many, much more time here, but do you think Trump will be reelected? If not, who could beat him?
Well, that allows me to give a 60-second reprise of the column I wrote this week, which was Monday night I watched Trump's entire rally in El Paso, and I may be the only one who actually watched all 85 minutes, but it was absolutely mesmerizing. Trump is able to perform at a very high level of political performance art now. It was extraordinary from start to finish. He's just like this, and it was mesmerizing. And I came away wondering whether any of the Democrats on the list, you all know their names, could compete with this guy. And I thought, not really. I don't think they can. The one that came to mind was Beto O'Rourke. And who's Beto O'Rourke? Well, the one thing Beto has is charisma. And you need a certain kind of dynamism and charisma. It's just really hard to put your finger on it to compete at that level. And no one barely knows what Beto O'Rourke stands for. That issue aside, and I do think the president's going to be really hard to compete with out on the campaign trail, one-on-one debates and so forth, not just somebody who's getting written about in the press, that if the Democrats do manage, because of the progressives feeling they have taken over the party, they do nominate someone who, after all these debates they're going to hold, clearly is a representative of the American left, Medicare for all, free college tuition, and all the rest of it, that voters may simply default again to Donald Trump, the same way they defaulted to him the first time.
Mm-hmm. Before we have the last question, we want to thank you for being here. We have a couple of books on Marco Island and Naples that we will give you in a moment. And lastly, and this would be good for students too, what mix of media outlets would be good to read or for us to watch in order to give a relatively balanced take on what's happening?
What a softball. Part of my speech I left out. I'll put it in very quickly. The New York Times clearly has adopted progressive politics, progressive culture as a business model. You really see in their art section, but it's on their front page, and they have gone to the left. The Washington Post has pretty clearly gone to the left. The Wall Street Journal, as a business proposition, and if our CEO, Will Lewis, were standing here, he would tell you this, that the Journal has decided that there is a base of readers out there who still want their news pretty much down the middle or relatively straight. And that is the Journal's target audience right now. And we're doing pretty well with it. So I just objectively, I mean, the editorial page, we have our own strong opinions. But I think our news reporters play it pretty darn straight. And I will say as well that I know Brett Baer is supposed to talk here pretty soon, that Fox is famous for Sean and Laura and Tucker. That's what they do from 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock at night. And that's what MSNBC does with its own people. That's the business model in the evening on American cable television. But by and large, during the day, I'm on Fox a lot during the day, and I know those people. And there's a lot of terrific reporters, and I think you'd probably say the same thing for CNN. During the day, a lot of these reporters are basically trying to report the news as straight as they can. It's kind of the hyper-partisan websites and talk radio and evening news that gets the reputation for bending and spinning the news the way it is. But there's so much out there. If you look, sample it, I think you can find outlets and sources of information that you begin to trust. I must say, though, the collusion story is another subject altogether. The media has just snapped on this collusion thing.
Well, we're very happy to have you. Thank you so much, Dan Henniger.
Thank you.